Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Last week, an old and dear friend of mine died. I want to share a little bit of his story with you as we go on through the day, because it's a story of, in many ways, what has happened in America and what happened in Germany. His name was Armin Lehman. And Armin, if you saw the movie Downfall, in that movie, the last guy to see Hitler alive was a 16-year-old kid who was a courier, Hitler's last courier, who brought to Hitler the news that basically all was lost, and then stood outside his room as Hitler went in and shot himself. And that was Armin. That was my friend Armin. And I met Armin, 20 or more years ago. I was teaching workshops in the travel industry. This must have been 60, or excuse me, this must have been 87 or thereabouts, and 21 years ago. And we taught these seminars for American Express, for KLM Airline, all over the world. Armin and I traveled. Armin was teaching travel marketing, basically, marketing and promotion, as was I. And I didn't know at the time. I just knew that he was this very nice guy with a German accent. And it wasn't until a decade or more after I got to know Armin that I got to know who he was and what he was all about and what he had to say. And so let me first, before I tell you the story of Armin, share with you, you know, heard at the Obama rally or at the Palin rally in Ohio, misconceptions about Obama. Let me just play this, and then I want to share with you my conversation with Armin from several years ago.
A small town in the swing state of Ohio is where Sarah Palin addresses some of her core supporters. This area is mostly white and working class, and here's what some have to say about presidential candidate Barack Obama.
I'm afraid if he wins, the blacks will take over. It's not a question. This is a Christian nation. What is our country going to end up like?
When you've got a Negro running for high president, you need a first stringer. He's definitely a second stringer.
He seems like a sheep or a wolf in sheep's clothing, to be honest with you. And I believe Palin, she's filled with the Holy Spirit, and I believe she's going to bring honesty and integrity to the White House.
He's related to a known terrorist. For one,
he is friends with the terrorists of this country.
He must support terrorists. You know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it must be a duck. And that, to me, is Obama.
Just the whole Muslim thing and everything. I mean, everybody's still kind of, a lot of people have forgotten about 9/11, but I don't know. It's just kind of a little unnerving.
Obama and his wife, I'm concerned that they could be anti-white, that he might hide that.
I don't like the fact that he thinks us white people are trash, because we're not.
So these were just, I mean, this guy just walked down the line of people who were standing in line to get into the Palin rally and said, what do you think about Barack Obama? And these were the kinds of responses that we got. And so Armin saw this happen. I mean, he saw it. There's a nice article, Margie Boulay in today's Oregonian wrote a nice piece about it. Armin actually was living in Coos Bay, Oregon, where we're on the air. And when he died, he died on the 10th of October. He was 4 years old. As I'm reading from Margie's piece, he was 4 years old when the Third Reich began and 16 when it ended before his eyes. It took the rest of his life for Armin to learn to forgive himself. His nightmares never went away. On Hitler's 56th birthday in 1945, Armin said, I still idolized Hitler. He was 16 years old. He wrote in his autobiography, Hitler's Last Courier, which you can find over at Amazon and in most bookstores. Margie writes, Armin had seen Hitler speak 7 years before. Now he looked much older, Armin wrote. He appeared to have shrunk. His steps appeared uncoordinated, insecure. His entire body trembled, even his head. Armin became a courier at the bunker as the Allies closed in. He dodged bullets all day, taking messages to and from military leaders in the field. Other couriers deserted or were killed. Armin stayed until he was the only boy left, carrying messages for Hitler, Goebbels, and Himmler. I never knew the contents of the envelopes, he said, but he saw the reactions, grief, and panic. He says, the last time I saw Adolf Hitler was April 30th, the day Hitler died. It was between 4 and 6 a.m. Armin was waiting in the Situation Room. The bunker was out of supplies. Hitler appeared like a ghost and looked right through me, said Armin. Hours later, Hitler was dead. Trying to escape the bunker, Armin was shot in the spine. He ended up weeks later in an American prison where he was shown films of the liberation of Nazi concentration camps. His wife, Kim, said, Armin said he was in shock. He couldn't sleep, eat, or drink for 3 days. Other guys said it's Hollywood. It can't be true. But he said he felt in his gut it was true. He felt horrible guilt. Armin became a pacifist and spent the rest of his life traveling the world on a peace mission. He and his wife settled on the Oregon coast. They were married for 29 years. Here's an interview that I did on the air with my old friend Armin Lehman back on October 3rd, 2005. And it's just about 2 minutes of audio I want to share with you. I think very cautionary audio.
Now, for those of you who saw the movie Downfall about the last days of Adolf Hitler, the young teenage boy, you were what, 12, 13 at the time, Armin?
16.
Okay. The 16-year-old boy who was in that movie, who was delivering the last message to Adolf Hitler in the Führer bunker in Berlin, telling him that essentially all was lost, that boy in that movie, in real life, was Armin Lehman. And Armin lives in a city that carries our program, and Armin and I have kept in touch over the years. And Armin's book is now out. It's called In Hitler's Bunker. It's been reprinted and republished by, who's your publisher now?
Well, the right is in England, but Zion's Press in the United States.
You know, one of the things that fascinated me was the idea of homeland. In Germany, Adolf Hitler and Rudolf Hess were big students of the Zionist movement in the 20s, and they had this idea that if they could get Germans to think of themselves as a race apart, as a race separate from everybody else, and you know, the idea of Blut und Erde, blood and soil, blood and earth, that they could create a fanatic. I don't know how to describe it, but, you know, just a cult, as it were. A homeland. Here's Rudolf Hess actually introducing this word, and you can tell us what he's saying after he says it.
Dank Ihrer Führung wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen, Heimat zu sein. Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt.
So, what did he say?
Yeah, thanks to your leadership, Germany will be homeland for the Germans. Family like I, where my father and my grandfather were pro-Hitler, you as a little boy became convinced that that was the truth.
See, here's the thing to keep in mind, and this is the point that it's so important to make. In the United States, when the Great Depression happened in the 1930s, the early 1930s, we had in the United States Franklin Roosevelt as president. And we chose a path out of it that involved the WPA and all these marvelous things. The Germans had Hitler as their leader. And we went in very different directions. We may be facing that choice again. 45 minutes past the hour.
Okay, so here I am back again. That was from October 3rd, 2005. And I'm sorry there wasn't more of Armin. There was so much of me in that clip. But if you go over to TomHartmann.com and click on our archives, you can, and just, you know, type in Armin Lehman's name, you can find the entire 7 minute interview with Armin, 7-8 minutes. And Armin Lehman, rest in peace, Armin, died on October 10th at the age of 80, and he was one of the last people to see Hitler alive. And Armin, on numerous occasions, told me how concerned he was that the United States was moving in this direction. And here we see now, 3 years ago, this conversation that Armin and I had, and I think that we are seeing You know, Armin's big thing was when they began dividing us from each other, when they began demonizing people within the country. That was the beginning of the end of the Germany that he knew as a very young child, and that became the Germany that he joined when he was a teenager and ended up as Hitler's last courier, which is the new title. His book is out with the new title, Hitler's Last Courier, when he was 14 years old. And Armin Lehman, a cautionary tale for all of us of what happens when a nation is divided by small-time demagogues and would-be tin pot dictators, the likes of Karl Rove and Steve Schmidt and Sarah Palin, and tragically, John McCain. Let us hope and pray that this country does not go down that road. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program, 21 minutes past the hour. You know, on October 16, 2008, in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Karl Rove didn't quite say that he was going to steal the election from Obama, but it was titled, Obama Hasn't Closed the Sale, and he wrote, McCain is narrowing his travels almost exclusively to Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, Ohio, Missouri, Colorado, and Nevada. If he carries those states while losing only Iowa and New Mexico from the GOP's 2004 total, Mr. McCain will carry 274 Electoral College votes and the White House. It's threading the needle, but it's come to that. So how might they pull this off? Well, for example, in Ohio, where the Secretary of State is trying to keep 220,000 people on the voting rolls, and the Republicans are trying to get them removed, aggressively trying to get them removed. The Secretary of State's office is now getting denial of service attacks, you know, taking down the website. By the way, Alan Raymond, the guy who wrote How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative, this is the guy who was phone banking in New Hampshire when John Sununu was running against Gene Sheehan 6 years ago. And he was jamming the lines of the Democratic volunteer offices where they were doing a get out the vote thing. This is a very, very, very tight race. And by preventing the Democrats from being able to call people to say, you know, do you need a ride to the polls? Can we get you to the polls? Things like that. He was able to flip that election. And he's now written a book about it, How to Rig an Election, Confessions of a Republican Operative. And he also talks about using denial of service attacks at things like the Secretary of State's website, and that's sure enough what's happening. Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Brunner announced on Monday afternoon that the state website has been set in a static mode, limited functionality as a precaution. Quote, due to security concerns experienced by the Secretary of State's website, full functionality has been suspended. So you can't quite check your vote. You can't check your registration right now in Ohio because the Republicans are doing these denial of service attacks, or Republican hacks are. Meanwhile, over 90% of our vote, this is an increase of 49.6% over the 2006 election, 90% of our vote will be counted on machines owned by, black box machines owned and serviced by companies, Republican companies like Diebold, where Diebold Premier, where the former president of the company said, you know, he's committed to getting to helping George Bush win Ohio. This was in the 2004 election. ESNS, in its previous incarnation, it's been through a couple of name changes, but previously the CEO of that company was Republican Chuck Hagel. Hart InterCivic, and Microvote. These four Republican-affiliated companies will count 91% of our votes this year nationwide. Snopes now has come out and confirmed the danger of straight ticket voting, by the way. Snopes, you know, pretty solid, and they're pointing out that in a lot of states, if you vote straight ticket, then your vote for president will not be counted. So don't vote straight ticket. Go right down and punch every single or marker, however you do it, every single race. Every single race. I mean, this is you know, downright weird. And of course, I've shared with you yesterday the vote flipping. We've got six counties now in West Virginia where people walk in and they punch the button for Obama and it flips to McCain. Not a single report yet, because I guarantee you if there was, it would be on Fox News. Not a single report yet of somebody walking in pushing a McCain button and having it flip to Obama. The same as in 2004, the same as in 2006, the Democratic Party still refusing to deal with this because they're still listening to the advice of their crazed advisors from 4 and 8 years ago who said, oh, we can't talk about election fraud, we can't talk about voter fraud, because it'll cause people to think that they shouldn't show up to vote. No, it'll cause people to think that they have to show up to vote, because if they're going to steal 5 or 10 million votes, we have to turn out 15 or 20 million extra voters this year. This is the most important election to vote in. And even if our votes are counted on electronic machines, and even if they're insecure, and even if they're doing vote caging, which they are, and even if they're doing vote purging, which they are, 1 in 6 voters now stripped off the rolls in Colorado, a big battle over 200,000 voters in Ohio, enough to flip the state. Keep in mind, John Kerry supposedly lost Ohio last time by just a little over 100,000 votes. There's still 100,000 provisional ballots in Ohio that haven't been counted. No matter how hard they try to steal this election, because that's all they can do.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote.
Paul Weyrich here.
I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Absolutely. That's the Republican mantra. This year, it's been the Republican mantra for, I mean, Paul Weyrich said that 15 years ago. It's been the Republican mantra for a long, long time. They know the majority, over 70% of Americans, want a national health care system. How are they going to vote? Over 70%, over 80% of Americans want solid Social Security. They're not going to vote Republican. McCain wants to privatize it. So the only thing they can do, keep us from voting.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270. Well, you know those times when you feel like there's a sign there on your back. Says I don't mind if you kick me, seems like everybody has. Things go from bad to worse, you think they can't get worse than that, and then they do. You step off the straight and narrow and you don't know where you are. Use the needle of your compass to sew up your broken heart. Ask directions from a genie in a bottle of Jim Beam and she lies to you. That's when you learn the truth. You're going through hell. Keep on going, don't slow down. If you're scared, no show it, you might get out. For the devil even knows you're there.
And a great description of the times we live in. 35 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Looks like Joe Biden, in a way, he might have put his foot in his mouth, you know, saying, well, you know, in 6 months, I'm expecting Barack Obama's going to be tested by an international crisis. It's actually, you know, he's speaking the truth. It's quite predictable. Every new president is, frankly. And Madeleine Albright coming to Biden and Obama's defense. But the fact of the matter is, either new president will be tested, in my humble opinion. And frankly, you know, the test is simply an ongoing process. Dave in Indiana. Hey, Dave, thanks for calling. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, good morning, Tom. I don't know if you've been following what's going on in Indiana. It's normally a red state, a real, you know, red, always a red state, but this year in Northwest Indiana, normally in past years, they only allow early voting in the center town, in the center of the state, Crown Point, which is a small town of about 20,000. This year, though, during the primary, they allowed three satellites up in Gary, Hammond, and East Chicago. Well, now that, so the Republicans didn't mind that, but now that the primary are here, they say, oh no, we can't have election, early, voting going on in those three cities. So what they're saying is they said, hey, and so there's judges now who are, I guess, going to rule on it tomorrow, whether or not it could continue. And their excuse is if voting continued in those areas, that there would be, there'd be voter fraud occurring. And if that isn't ridiculous, because what is it, Indiana passed that ID law where you had to have your ID to prevent voter fraud.
I know, I know. It, really what they're worried about is, that, you know, McCain's got some incredible slime coming. I'm guessing that they're going to probably run some really, really bad Reverend Wright ads, which, you know, are those were pretty powerful in terms of scaring white people by and large. And you know, I mean, Obama wasn't even at the church when Wright said that. It was the one time that he went off like that. And frankly, the context was, I love America so much, I don't want to see her go down this road. That was the, you know, the context of Reverend Wright's speech. A guy who, by the way, was a Marine and served, you know, he served his country with honor and distinguishment. But I'm pretty sure that they've got some major slime coming down the road, and they don't want people to vote until they've been exposed to it.
Yeah, one other point I want to make, too, if I could.
Yeah.
CNN reported the other day about, and this is, I've been thinking of this for years now, after the 2004 election, is a guy who's been arrested in, I guess, California somewhere, where the Republicans, he's getting people to sign stuff, and they think they're signing a petition, and it's really a voter request, a voter registration form. But what he's doing, he's switching them to Democrat. And someone says, well, and they did it in Florida in 2004, where they were getting Hispanics, and they would check the Democrat or the Republican. Well, some people say, well, what's the difference? You don't have to vote that way. Well, that's true. But the problem is that when they go flip the vote on the electronic voting machines, they could say, oh, but look at how many registered Democrats we have and how many registered Republicans.
Right.
So
yeah, it makes it easier. It makes it easier to steal an election.
Yeah.
And B, it causes people not to get communications from the Democratic Party. And, you know, it's and the guy, by the way, his name is Mark Jacoby. Or Jacoby, I'm not sure how he pronounces it, J-A-C-O-B-Y. His company's called Young Political Majors, YPM. He doesn't live in California, but he registered himself to vote there at an address where he no longer lives, where he was apparently born, a childhood address, so that he would be legally eligible to run a company gathering signatures in California. This is a crime, and he has been arrested for voter fraud. This Republican, he has been paid by the Republicans. They're operating all across, not just California, but a number of states. I have a friend we had dinner with on Saturday night who apparently signed one of his petitions because she's now getting all this fundraising stuff from the Republican Party. He was paid $7 to $12 for every Californian that he re-registered as a member of the GOP, by the way. This, you know, you're right. Voter fraud and election fraud are the Republican stock and trade. What the Democrats and what Acorn are trying to do is simply get people registered to vote, period. Get them out there and registered to vote. And if some of the people that they hire write down Mickey Mouse because they want to get a paycheck, Mickey Mouse is not going to show up at the polls. That's not fraud at the election level. That's fraud, you know, that's Acorn being defrauded. Acorn is the victim of that, and they're doing the very best. They've actually cooperated with the police in prosecuting people who have defrauded them. So, you know, anyhow, Gary in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Yeah, Mickey Mouse might show up at the polls when John McCain goes to vote.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, I voted yesterday here in Broward County, which is Fort Lauderdale, and I left with a very, very insecure feeling about my vote. I was given four pieces of paper that I had to bubble in the candidates that I wanted to select and the amendments and the little laws that I wanted to pick.
Right.
And after you fill them all in, you take those four pieces of paper and you slide them into another machine that reads them.
Right.
And I put three in, one after another, and I heard a very, very faint beeping sound. And I stopped before I put the fourth one in, and I looked at the bottom left corner of the screen. It said accept. When I pushed accept, the beeping stopped, and I put my fourth one in. Then I asked the poll workers, I said, now I'm concerned that I should have hit accept after every page. They said, don't worry about it. And I said, but I am worried about it. I don't think those other pages were going to count. He says, just don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine. And then some woman came over to me and she said, just go outside and there'll be somebody out there from your party that you can speak to. And I went outside and there wasn't a soul out there. It was just a way to get me out of the library where I was voting.
Wow.
And I'm very concerned that I don't know how many of those pages didn't count.
Was this a largely Democratic area?
I would say it was mixed. Yeah. It was in downtown Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah.
And there was every imaginable age and type of person there. But yeah, most people were wearing Obama T-shirts. I will say that.
Yeah. Yeah, see, I mean, they know that there are so many people who are going to vote for Obama. I mean, you know, Obama shows up in town, 70,000 people show up. McCain shows up in town, 35 people show up. I mean, literally, that's how it's been the last couple of weeks. And, you know, when Sarah Palin shows up, maybe she'll draw a crowd of curiosity seekers, mm-hmm, basically. But they know that this vote is going to go so overwhelmingly for McCain that they're just doing everything they can to disenfranchise voters. That's a scary story. Gary, thanks a lot for giving us a shout on it. I appreciate it. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice.
Hi, Tom. About 3 weeks ago, I had heard on the radio that a straight party vote on the ballot would not include the vote for president.
That's right, in some states.
Pardon?
In some states, that's the case, yes.
Yeah. Oh, I called Dearborn City Clerk and was assured it did, but then when I called the Michigan Secretary of State, they transferred me four times to give me an answer.
Yeah.
And then they said, oh, yes, it includes the vote for president. But
I think it does in Michigan. I don't have the list of the states where it doesn't in front of me. But then there's also a concern that some of the voting machines are set up where it just doesn't work.
You know, what I did, I used an absentee ballot.
Mm-hmm.
I voted individually for everybody.
Yeah, I think that's the wisest thing to do, wherever you may be.
And I cautioned my family and friends to vote directly for president and for all the others and to avoid the straight ticket.
Yeah.
And then I did that on my absentee ballot. And then what was strange on the absentee ballot is my original application for the absentee ballot used my middle initial. On the absentee ballot I got, they didn't have my middle initial, so I had to be really careful not to use it.
Yeah, although you don't live in Indiana where that would disqualify you. I'm not sure that would disqualify you in
Michigan.
Yeah,
so, you know, I just don't trust what's going on.
They are doing everything they can. They are following the Paul Weyrich playbook right down the road. They're doing everything they can. Thank you, Bernice, for the call. They're doing absolutely everything they can to get as many people off the rolls as possible because they know that otherwise this is going to be a landslide. And Joe the plumber, ironically enough, because his Wurzelbacher name is spelled Wurzelbacher with an O instead of a U on his voter registration card, may not be able to vote. Maybe he's one of the 200,000 in Ohio, except he didn't vote. He didn't register recently. The 200,000 that they're challenging are the recent registrants, which everybody pretty much knows are Democratic registrants. So Harvey in Houston, Texas. Hey, Harvey.
Yes, Tom, I'm concerned about that. With the voting, I voted yesterday because they had the early voting, and I voted straight Democrat. Is there a chance that my vote won't be counted then for president?
Go over to votersunite.org. There's a website about it, and there's several articles about it. There's also at Snopes.com/politics/ballot/straighttticket.asp. You can see the thing, but you know, the bottom line, there are 15 states that use straight ticket voting, and of the 15 states. Let's see here. Alabama, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Michigan, New Mexico, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Texas, Utah, West Virginia, Wisconsin. And, the question is, in some of these states, they specifically say, you know, the straight ticket ballot does not include the president and senatorial races. In others, they simply may have the machines programmed that way.
Yeah.
Even though it's not that way in those states. And so, you know, go over to votersunite.org and check the thing out. But the bottom line is, just to be safe, don't vote a straight party ticket.
I did already. I did yesterday.
Oh, you did?
That's the problem.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't think that Texas is one of the states. Dig into the Snopes article. I will do so during the break, too, and I'll try to get the very, very specific details for you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I believe James Hoffa is going to drop by in our next segment and say hi, and we will continue with the program as moving along here. The Tom Hartman program. joining the fight by taking on the Reich.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman program at HartmanRadio.com.
Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. James Hoffa is with us. He's the general president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Teamster.org is the website. Our program, in fact, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. And James Hoffa, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. It's great to be back on.
Great to have you back with us, sir. You have been campaigning in Ohio to keep jobs in America. And this former Mr. Coffee plant, tell me about this.
Well, we went to Mr. Coffee. Right now, it's an empty lot. It's unbelievable. There used to be a factory there. And we did a segment with the local television, and we had a young lady there from HERE, which is one of our sister unions. And she was telling the story about her plant where she works, another plant. She has five children. And they're closing the plant and moving it to Honduras. That, you know, it's the same story as Mr. Coffee, which, getting back to Mr. Coffee, 9 years ago, we had 500 people there. And that was the time, remember Joe DiMaggio used to talk about Mr. Coffee?
Yep, yep.
Well, they closed it down, no warning to the people, and moved the entire plant to Mexico. And now, I mean, the final irony is those are now made in China. And when I did the segment, I had the latest Mr. Coffee, and I went and showed on the bottom. It says, made in China. Those are jobs that were here. They were making money here, but yet corporate greed said, let's make more money. Let's lay off the Americans, and let's move it to Mexico. Then they laid off the Mexicans, and now the race to the bottom, now they're in China.
Yeah. Well, it's not just corporate greed, though. I mean, here's the problem. In 1791, Alexander Hamilton presented his plan for the industrialization of the United States to Congress, and it was adopted. And they put into place 25% import tariffs. From 1791 until the 1980s, we never went below 25%. The theory was, if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in Connecticut, and you want to make those shoes in China where there's 20 cents worth of labor, there's going to be an 80 cent tax when they hit the border. If you want to make them in Mexico where there's a 50 cents worth of labor, it's going to be a 50 cent tax when it hits the border. The tariffs constituted 100% of the revenue of the federal government right up until the Civil War. Half the revenue of the federal government until World War I. A third of the revenue of the federal government until World War II. And Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. successively have driven our tariffs down to the point where our average import tariffs in the United States are 2%. China, if you want to sell a General Motors car in China, it's a 20% import tariff into China. But if China wants to sell a car in the United States, it's a 2.1% import tariff. Our trade policies are absolutely screwed.
Absolutely. You know, I have a saying. I say that big business got NAFTA and CAFTA, and the workers of America got the SHAFTA.
It's absolutely, you're absolutely
and,
right.
And that is what's going on. And let's blame both people. It's both Democrats and Republicans.
Yep.
Because Bill Clinton passed NAFTA, and he passed the China Trade Agreement.
And of course,
George Bush is owned by big business. He went right down the line on every trade pact that has sold out the American worker today.
Yeah, this has been going on for 26 years. Ronald Reagan brought this thing in with him. Let's make the world safe for multinational corporations. To hell with the American worker. And in fact, kick the whole thing off by busting up PATCO, you know, his war on organized labor and war on the middle class. And it has not stopped. It has not relented. Yes, Bill Clinton created a lot of jobs. An awful lot of them were, do you want fries with that? We have just seen this continual erosion of manufacturing in the United States to the point where the only country in the world that in the last two decades has threatened us with a nuclear weapon, China, is the country that we have to go to buy chips if we want to make a cruise missile.
Well, it's ridiculous. And, you know, the same thing you were talking about, the example of China. You know, South Korea, everybody knows that they're shipping millions of cars here. The ships come in directly from South Korea. And you cannot, it's almost impossible to sell an American car or anything into their economy. It's the most protected, tariff-heavy economy.
Yeah,
they don't let anything in. They just want to sell to us, but they won't let us sell to them.
Right, which is what, and it used to be that at least there was balance. We had average tariffs. I mean, they got as high as 40% during World War II and actually through much of our country. You know, during after the Civil War, our tariffs were running around 40%. Smoot-Hawley took them from 36 to 38%, which was just a small adjustment. But by and large, our tariffs have averaged around 35% throughout our history, as did most other countries. And then you would have exceptions to the tariffs where there were things that you really didn't care. I mean, carved sandalwood from Thailand, obviously we're not going to have a tariff for that. It's not an industry where we're trying to compete. But in those areas where we want to keep jobs in the United States, the only reason that we made clothing in the United States for 200 years was because we had tariffs. The only reason that we, frankly, made pretty much anything. It's we, and I know, you know, tariffs isn't necessarily your thing. It's my thing. It's I want to go back to a country that protects its domestic industries and protects its workers. And that requires unionization, strong unionization, and a trade policy that protects our domestic industries. And stop giving tax breaks to companies that go overseas, which is the McCain plan.
Well, you know, that's also one of the good things, you know, one of the things why I work for Barack Obama is he's got the employer, the Patriot Act, which is basically going to reward people that keep plants in this country and, you know, basically tax those people that want to ship their jobs overseas or close their plants.
Yeah.
And that's what we need. We're not going to subsidize you moving to Mexico. We're going to put a penalty on you, and that's what you got to do.
Yeah,
we've really, and this election is about trade as much as anything else, and we've got to make sure that Barack Obama, you know, he did a good job on the debate talking about, you know, talking about Colombia trade agreement, and mm-hmm. we've got to hold everybody's feet to the fire that we want jobs in America, we want to stop shipping jobs out, and that's one of the commitments we've got to make sure that Barack Obama keeps.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that, and therefore voting is not enough. And the real work begins on Guy Fawkes Day on November 5th, the day after the election, when we have to get out there and say, okay, now you're elected. Here's the agenda, you know, that we want to be pushing, you know, we the people.
That's
James,
right.
James Hoffa, the general president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, teamster.org is the website. Check it out. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Great talking to you.
Good talking to you, too, again. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. The Postman coming up next. Why should you consider walking away from an upside-down mortgage?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our show. Should you walk away, just walk away from an upside-down mortgage? Particularly if it was one that you're not really sure it was all that kosher to begin with. The Postman is with us. He's the author of a book called Choose Foreclosure, The Case for Walking Away. The website, Choose Foreclosure, and there's two E's in foreclosure, foreclosure.com. And the Postman, welcome to the show.
Tom, what an honor to be on your air. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm curious, why did you write this book essentially anonymously, and do you have any interest in revealing your identity here?
I don't have any interest at this point, not at least not initially. The main point for me was that we have so much politics today, and I myself have been involved in politics and so on and so forth, and I didn't want reviewers saying, well, this guy had done this and he'd done that and so on and so forth. I wanted the book to stand on its own, on the facts and the information, the material that's presented inside. And as you well know, Madison and Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, they used a pen name, if you will, Publius, when they were writing the Federalist Papers. So it's kind of a time-honored element to go anonymous, if you will, and the postman brings the news and information. I was, you know, a book about that, and Kevin Costner did the film The Postman, and that's the whole intention, is just to have the book initially judged on its content.
But yeah, you have been active politically. You do hold a real estate license. This is both the political waters and the real estate waters are things that you are very, very familiar with, as I can definitely tell from reading your book.
Yeah, well, absolutely the case. And the real estate license came late, 3 or 4 years ago. I started writing a newsletter about it and moved that over to the web. And I began to understand that something was very, very wrong and that we were all being caught up in a mania that drove housing prices higher and higher and higher.
Right.
Then the real problem, it came in, and that led me to further studies and discovering predatory lending.
Right. Let's get into the essence of this book. There's two parts to this book that I found particularly fascinating and I'd like to discuss with you. One is the practical application of walking away from a mortgage and why do that. And in fact, you say don't choose bankruptcy and how those are mutually exclusive. And the other is this whole concept of business cycles, which you've actually done a brilliant job of, a fairly thorough analysis of, and the various theories of business cycles. How is it that these things happen from Clement Juggler through Kondratieff?
I don't know. I only read it.
It's a word I've never heard pronounced, a name I've never heard pronounced, but I've always read Kondratieff, let's say, and the whole idea of the his winter. But let's start out with somebody's got a house that they paid $400,000 for at the peak of the bubble in California, where housing prices are pretty high, and they were able to afford it because they got, you know, a bank or a mortgage broker gave them a note that for the first 5 years has a 2.5% or 3% rate and then adjusts up, and they figured that, you know, they'd be able to refinance within that 5 years, and so no problem. And now they find they can't refinance, and the thing is going to adjust up to 10% or 12%, and their payments are going to just about double, and it's going to be way more than they can afford. What should they do, in your opinion?
Well, I'm a little predisposed. They should buy and read the book, Choose Foreclosure, The Case for Walking Away, for the simple reason they'll understand their options. I mentioned the predatory lending, and they need to understand the tragedy. You know, we've had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who have lost their homes in the last year and a half or so, who accepted foreclosure. It was done on them, and they walked away in despair and feeling embarrassed and so on and so forth, and they never knew, because this has not been brought forward, the issues of predatory lending and how they were drawn into a loan that was inappropriate. I mean, I could give you a list of things if you wanted to do, you know.
Let me assure you that if you reveal the contents of the book on this show, if you tell people what's actually in it, you will sell more copies than if you tease it, because people will go, holy cow, I need to know that. I need to have that in writing. I need to find, and I'm telling you, as an author, I can tell you absolutely that's the case. Lay it out here. Tell us what, you know, why is this not a risky choice? Why, you know, isn't this going to destroy somebody's credit if they do this, for example?
That's what they're trying to tell you. That's what Paulson has been saying, and Freddie Mac has been saying, is that you'll never be able to buy a house for 7 years. It's not true. It's documented in the book from the manager at FICO, you know, Fair Isaac, that you'll have a credit hit for a couple of years. All you have to do is repair your credit. And, you know, we recommend that people use a credit restoration agency, if you will.
Right.
You repair your credit, you save money for a down payment.
Right.
And the critical point, second sub-theme of the book, is price discovery leading to affordability. The prices of all these homes have to come down. And until they do, we're not even going to have a balanced economy across the board.
Right. So what's price discovery?
Price discovery is an economics jargon term, and it simply means the prices revert to the mean, or in other words, they go back to where they were before a bubble started blowing. In this case, we're looking at prices from 1997 to 2000, 2001, and prices reverting back to there. And they've just gone up, you know, astonishingly, three times in your states like California, Florida, Arizona, and Nevada.
Although the value of the dollar in that time has dropped by about 15%. So we would expect that there would be an appreciation of at least 15%, simply reflecting the loss of, purchasing power of the dollar.
All right, but you made an example of purchase at $400,000. Now, say it's 2 years later, and the house across the street, which you know is really very much like your house, just sold for $3,000. You've just lost 25%.
Right.
Now, you're going to continue to pay for maybe 7 or 8 years. In Japan, it took 16 years for that house to go down to its full bottom, which will take 2 more years at least, and then another 5 or 6 years to come back up to $400,000. Meanwhile, you've paid all this interest.
Right.
It's a real losing proposition. Whereas if you live in a state that has non-recourse and non-judicial, and all this is pointed out in the book. I'm not trying to tease the book. In fact, there's a great state-by-state guide in the book where you can click on a link, and it'll take you right to your own state, and you can see exactly what the laws are.
Yeah, there is. And the book is called Choose Foreclosure, The Case for Walking Away. The website is chooseforeclosure.com. But so... what are the, you know, first of all, I can just hear people going, but this is irresponsible. You're talking about walking away from an obligation. That's immoral.
Well, you know, we get socialized, and we want to do the right thing, and we want to be ethical, and we want to have respect in our community and the larger community. But this is a business decision. That's what this is about. Corporations have no hesitancy from walking away from a deal they don't like, throwing the lawyers. Well, in this case, because of the prevalence of predatory lending, you can bring in a lawyer, because I'm not advising. And if you read the book all the way through, you must have seen that at least 10 times I say you can't do this at home. You need an attorney. You need to, you know, consult with local counsel who understands about this, because if you can bring an action to the lender, where your attorney alleges predatory lending, and it's there in the documents, then you have leverage to negotiate one of two things. Maybe you really want to stay. People want to stay. They don't want to walk away. Well, then you can not just do a loan modification and just get a lower interest rate for 5 years or what have you. You can negotiate for a principal reduction. In other words, you don't owe $400,000 anymore. You owe $300,000. That's the true market value.
Because you threatened the lender with an action against them for predatory lending practices.
Exactly. And, you know, it wasn't just the lenders. It it goes all the way up to the investment banks who, you know, securitize these loans. We won't go into that unless you want. But it comes all the way down to the original lender, the mortgage broker, the appraiser. These people were involved in kicking the price up. That was their interest because their fees were kicked up. And the irony is they all had no risk. That risk was passed right up to investors who bought these mortgage-backed securities.
Right.
And just one little number in here. In the last 5 years, 29% of every new loan origination in the last 5 years is underwater right now. And it's going to be multi-million. In fact, it's 16% of every home in America right now is underwater. And
that's,
people
that's
have to
nuts.
Face.
That's nuts. I mean, that's insane. We haven't seen that since 1930, 1931.
Well, that's what we have again. And that's sort of the doom and gloom part I'm hesitant to go forward with, because there's going to be a lot of pain. So I'm saying you want to take control of your life and take action,
right?
Or do you want to have something done to you? And the book, well, you just said it. I try to explain everything in there, all of your options, so then you can make a decision.
Okay, can you stick around over the break for the next segment? I want to get into this business cycle stuff with you, and we haven't had an opportunity to talk about it.
I'd love to.
Okay, we're talking with The Postman. His book, Choose Foreclosure, The Case for Walking Away, the website chooseforeclosure.com. 16 minutes past the hour, right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting. For a change.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah. Welcome back to the Mel Bearing Zone. 21 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program. We're talking with The Postman, the author of a new book, a seemingly outrageous concept, Choose Foreclosure, the case for walking away. And The Postman, welcome back.
Thank you. And how ironic you've got Gimme Shelter on there.
It seems like the perfect one here. It's, you know, Louise is very thoughtful about her bumper music.
Excellent.
Business cycles. You know, I want to get into that. I've got a couple callers here, though, first. Let's just pick up a couple callers and get them on with you. Karen in San Francisco, you have some thoughts on this, Karen?
Yeah, it's good you play that song. Listen, housing is shelter. When it becomes an investment tool, when it becomes speculative like it did, it leads to a bubble. And now everyone wants to prop up housing prices, or at least everyone who was involved in the housing bubble, banks, real estate agents, mortgage brokers, and
John McCain,
all the homeowners who took out all the money out of their house. But people like me, you know, public school teacher, I knew I couldn't afford a house that was $500,000. So I'm the one, I didn't drink the Kool-Aid, and I'm the one who's going to lose out if we keep trying to prop up housing prices. Housing prices have to be in line with salaries.
You're right.
Which is
You're right.
2 to 3 times what someone's annual salary is. And people keep saying, oh, we can't let housing prices fall. Yes, they have to fall.
Well, it's John McCain who's saying that he wants to buy mortgages at face value rather than at real value. Karen Wells.
We don't know what face value is until people let the prices fall.
I know, and they let the prices fall by walking away from them, and that resets the market. Am I right? Thank you, Karen. Am I right, Postman?
Hey, Karen, you're so right on. I mean, that leads to the sub-theme of the book, Price Discovery, Returning to Affordability. And dare I say it, this book is, in one sense, in the back of my mind, it's a manifesto to bring about housing prices. You know, Washington tells us this, and we do this, and taxpayers going to do the bailouts for the benefit of the investment banks. The bottom line, if enough people walk away, we take control of a larger context. Much larger context. You've got to have a balanced market where an affordable housing where normal or historical income to debt ratios are there.
Right.
They're not there now.
Right, but this bubble was brought about in large part by Alan Greenspan jacking down home interest rates, jacking down interest rates in general because wages weren't going up. And wages are the typical driver of demand in an economy. And because
right.
they weren't going up, demand wasn't going up. So he decided to make credit available instead. So everybody turned their home into an ATM machine because they weren't making a higher salary.
Exactly.
And there we are. So on the business cycles, you talk about business cycles and how, you know, we should just expect these things. But I would say that there's even more to it than that because we had Greenspan doing that. We had Phil Graham in 1999 blowing away Glass-Steagall that allowed banks to get into the gambling business, basically, the brokerage business. And,
right.
And then in 2002, you had Bill Seidman and others going to Greenspan saying, you know, there's all these mortgage-backed securities. They're not, you know, and these credit default swaps, they're actually a form of insurance, but they're not being called insurance, so they're not regulated as insurance. They're not being called stocks, so they're not regulated by the SEC. Nobody even knows how many there are out there. And Greenspan says, yes, and that's how it should be. This will prove my theory that the free market will always regulate itself.
Yeah, and there's 56 trillion of those out there, and they're going to implode too, I think. But that's, you know, that's a deeper issue. Well, you're so right. You know, your name in Greenspan, I think he's it. I think that you can, if you have to find one individual, specifically, he made a speech on February 23rd, 2004 at a builders conference, and he said all Americans should get adjustable rate mortgages. Now, he had interest rates down to 1% trying to emerge out of the dot-com blow up. Well, everybody got, and oh, the full sentence is, all Americans should get adjustable rate mortgages and manage their own risk. Well, a lot of people don't know what that means. We're not trained as economists.
Right.
Bottom line, 4 months later, he starts bumping up the interest rates. But nonetheless, this thing, you know, continued right till July, August, September of 2006. And then we crested over the top. The defaults started coming, and just an astonishing number from, you know.
So what does somebody do who's in the middle? What does somebody do who has a house that was, you know, was worth $400,000 a year ago, but they actually made a substantial down payment on it, or they've owned it for a while, and they've got a couple $100,000 paid down on it? Just that person basically has to what? Just ride it out?
Exactly. Exactly. We're not encouraging irresponsible, behavior. Just walk away because, you're angry at Congress and Paulson and Wall Street. That'd be ridiculous. It really affects the people, first-time buyers, people that have come in since, you could say 2004, 5, 6, 7. Those are the ones that have seen this write-up, and now they're seeing the fall down.
We got about 30 seconds here. A quick crash course on business cycles.
Business cycles in 30 seconds. What goes up comes down. It has happened through centuries. It always happens. Different people have put different time frames on it. Condrieff.
Where do you think this one's going to go?
Pardon me?
Where do you think this one's going to go?
It's going to go down. It's beginning. I mean, it's inevitable. And Greenspan said, had the arrogance in 63 to say, if I am ever Fed Treasury of the Fed, chairman of the Fed, I can stop a Kondratieff winter. He can't. He couldn't. And that's the end of the story. It's going to go down. Why not get out of harm's way is what I'm saying.
A Kondratieff winter is essentially a Great Depression.
That's correct. Every 50 years, and here we are again. And it's inevitable because people start handing out free money, basically.
No, this, you're absolutely right. And this whole thing with this economic stimulus package is nuts. It's just trying to buy them a few more months. The Postman, the book is Choose Foreclosure, The Case for Walking Away, ChooseForeclosure.com. Thank you, sir.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our full Monty alert. Uh-oh.
Real slow.
Okay, so the value of homes is down.
Baby, take off your shoes. I'll take your shoes.
And Bergdorf Goodman has reported a 15% drop in sales.
Baby, take off your dress.
And Saks is down 10.9%. But leave your hat on. Well, sort of. Sales are up 25% year over year in the erotic toy and lingerie business. So I guess we know what industry. Oh, my. During recessions, people go back to the basics. Okay, Choose Foreclosure, The Case for Walking Away, written by the Postman, ChooseForeclosure.com. We got a whole bunch of calls here, and Postman, we asked you to come back on to take some of these calls because you know this stuff inside out, and I don't claim to. You still with us?
I am, and before you take them, I want to make a quotation. This is from Tom Hartman. When stories change, the world changes. And I think your point in that is that new insights, when it reaches, moves through enough people, we reach a critical mass. This is a radical idea, I grant you. But I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to share this radical idea,
well,
if you will.
Let's get some thoughts from our listeners here. Philip in Boca Raton, Florida, you want to disagree with us or with the Postman on this? Anyway.
Yes, I do. I think it's a terrible idea. Because if you do this and people start walking away from their homes, then what happens is you put downward pressure on other homes. And then other people are forced to walk away from their homes. So you create a self-perpetuating spiral down. If anything, you want to keep people in their homes. The biggest asset in anyone's balance sheet is their home. If you get people to leave that asset, you will cause a collapse in demand. The economy runs on demand. You will cause a depression for sure, a self-fulfilling depression. So I think your idea is awful, awful.
So, Postman, your response.
Read the book. You have to realize that
that's not a response. Please respond.
All right. We have a depression on its way right now. That's inevitable. I tried to make the points regarding of home affordability. Why does a family pay a $400,000 note for 5 or 6 years, 7 years, maybe longer, when the home is worth $250,000. That is what doesn't make economic sense. And yes, we do need downward pressure. We need to bring the home values back to affordability based on historic income to debt ratio.
So the bottom line, I think what he's saying, Philip, is that these home values right now are not realistic. They're not real. They're not
based. I understand, but the only institution that can hold these instruments to make them more realistic is the government. So instead of going in and giving money to the banks, where we have no control of what they do, we should have bought out these mortgages with some.
But if you bought them out at the current price, you would still be maintaining the bubble.
No. What you do is you buy out a percent of the price. You buy out the differential that it's gone down.
Well, then you're going to see a collapse in values, which is what, Philip, you're saying you're concerned about.
Yeah, well, what I do is I hold the thing until I get the thing to come up. The only institution that can do that is the government. If they buy
Well, no, the banks can do that. As the postman said, you can go to your bank, and particularly if you threaten them with predatory lending, you can get them to change the actual principal, the actual value.
No, I'm not looking to change the principal. What I'm looking to do is to finance the depreciation, which is a fraction of the coin. You don't want to, if the house is $100,000, you don't want to finance $100,000. What you want to finance is a depreciation on the home. So that's equivalent, if the depreciation was 20% to 30%, that's equivalent to a guy getting a 30% increase in salary. It's not the full face value you're financing, it's the depreciation you're financing. So effectively what you've done, if the depreciation is 20%, you've got a 5-to-1 multiplier in a market.
But what we've had is appreciation, not depreciation.
I understand, but the current situation now is depreciation. So what the government should do is not finance the full face value. That's stupid. What they should do is just finance the differential.
Right, the depreciated value. Okay, so we're back to saying, and if the only way to make that happen is to walk. Okay, Postman, your thoughts on this. Thank you, Philip.
Well, again, it maintains the value. He's saying you're going to drop it down to market value. The banks have resisted this forever. So what he's saying is we socialize it. Take the paper off the bank's books so they don't have to show these losses proving that they're insolvent. Instead, all the taxpayers carry it. You think that's a fair and balanced way? I don't. Okay. And it still doesn't bring homes back to affordability where an average medium-priced buyer can buy an average medium-priced home. It's not
right.
possible today.
Right, and that's what we need to get back to is where the middle class can actually afford to buy their homes. Anthony in Seattle, you're on with the Postman.
Hey, I just wanted to echo what your guest said with taking it to the banks and threatening them with predatory lending. I kind of foresaw this whole thing a couple years ago. The bank offered, how they were really pushing people into different kind of loans. And essentially, they had overvalued my home by 150%. They sent out their own appraiser. I think they were in collusion with the appraisers. That's where I think a lot of there needs to be some regulatory oversight over the appraisers, because they totally violated their, fiduciary duty in appraising these homes.
So, but were you able to clean this up, or were you able to resolve it somehow, Anthony?
They changed my loan into a zero interest loan, and so I've just been paying it down. And I threatened them. I went to the state agency that oversees banks and credit unions and threatened them with predatory lending, and they cracked down on them. And they saw it for what it was. And I was just a rare case, but this was just about a year and a half ago before this whole thing came to a head.
Right.
And so I think that people
should. Here's Anthony Postman, who has done what you're suggesting, apparently.
Yeah, and he sounds a little sophisticated, and that's a wonderful thing. But the important point you made, Anthony, is regarding the appraisers. You know, these are people who have to make a living, too. They've been enforced, undue pressure, leverage by the lenders to what they called hit the numbers. You know,
well, in fact, let's bring an appraiser in here. Kelly in San Jose, California. You're an appraiser?
Perfect.
I've been an appraiser over 20 years.
Oh. So Kelly,
tell us about your experience, Kelly.
25 years as a licensed realtor as well. I'm very ethical, very honest. I had made the mistake of going to work for a subprime lender, one of the major lenders in the country, big name. And I was assured that they did everything ethical and that value was important to them, condition of property was key. So I go to work as a divisional manager, and I'm reviewing appraisals and supervising. I'm seeing garbage come through. So I start cutting values, putting conditions for mold, things, just trashed properties that they're overvalued. Well, the sales manager there cuts, he just would go into the computer screen, eliminate my stuff from the files, overthrow my value, you know, and just say override it. He'd put the value back in. There was stuff going on there that was just insane. So what I did is I reported him internally to their corporate fraud department. 6 weeks later, I got a letter back saying, you're fired.
Yes, exactly.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Kelly, did you know?
They hired lawyers to turn it around that I had done something wrong. So I fortunately got a good attorney's firm to represent me. And I was able to settle before they went under, but they did go under. And I tried to do the right thing always. And he's right as far as appraisers. We have to use comparable sales, what's sold, what's listed, what's pending. And a problem when you report an appraiser for violation, fraud, or maybe they just aren't educated, they don't know how to appraise certain properties, they need to go back to school, you have to document everything, and it cannot be done anonymously. And they can countersue you if for any reason they think you're trying to disparage them. So the problem with bad appraisers is it's very difficult to report into OREA, which California's, which right. is our oversight.
Okay. Kelly.
May I respond, Tom, to Kelly?
Sure.
This is just breaking news, Kelly, and I can't remember if it's Montana or Idaho, but a group of appraisers just filed a class action against Countrywide, exactly what you're talking about, and it's prevalent all over. I didn't get into it too much in the book, but I touched on it. And the fact is that when you're if you do bring an action, and with an attorney, a professional who understands this stuff, if you bring an action, you don't just name the lender or the mortgage broker, you name the appraiser. Everyone gets named in a complaint if you're making a complaint. In other words, they're not going to talk to you and so on and so forth, so you have to step forward. Right. Everybody gets named. And because everybody, or so many parties, had a part.
The appraisers are pushing back now. They're filing a class action lawsuit saying they've been basically forced into these kind of situations, which is what Kelly is reporting.
I got
a whole bunch more calls, and we only have a minute left. Kelly, thank you very much for your call. Ed in Los Angeles, you're on with the Postman, the author of Choose Foreclosure.
Yeah, I had a question, maybe your thoughts on this. Dennis Kucinich, financial advisor, was on another radio station about a month ago, and he claimed that if anybody was about to lose their home, meaning being kicked out on the street literally, what they could do is take the banks to court and ask to see the original copy of the loan, and then the banks would be tied up for at least a year or more because the loan's been sold and resold and resold and resold. And I wondered what your guest thoughts on that were. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks,
thank
Ed.
You.
It's a real big deal. In Ohio, federal judge Boyko threw out Deutsche Boyen Bank brought about 12-13, I'll be real quick, foreclosures in. And the judge said, well, okay, but show us the promissory note. If you don't possess the promissory note, you can't bring an action. You lack standing. And so they didn't have them. Why? Because all the notes are lost. I mean, they're in boxes and they got sold to this through investment bank here and went over to investor here. They can't find the original notes. And you have to, by law, in order to bring a foreclosure action, you have to have the note.
Yeah, so take it to them. Take it to them. The Postman, the book, Choose Foreclosure, The Case for Walking Away. Thanks for coming back and talking with us, sir.
Anytime, Tom.
Okay, great. I appreciate it. 46 minutes past the hour. Talk Radio News coming up next. Also, of course, our number, 866-303-2270. Our website, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, I'm going to go hang out there now during the break. And airamerica.com for a free video.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active.
Meow, 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 meow.
Uh-oh. It's our Higgins alert. Or our crazy cat alert. Yeah, Barack Obama and John McCain are both heading to New York for a cat show this weekend. Actually, Barack Obama may not be going because his grandmother in Hawaii is quite ill. But nonetheless, Obama the Bombay cat and McCain, actually neither one of the actual guys is going to go. It's a couple of cats. Obama the Bombay cat and McCain the American short hair are the two felines who are competing for the perfect president. I suspect my cat Higgins might think about voting for McCain because he's got such a bad attitude and he's so irascible. He's, you know, kind of personality-wise, pretty similar to McCain, so, but I still love him. What can I say? Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in the world today?
Wait, first of all, I want to give my non-scientific poll. For anybody that thinks that this election is over, I've got news for you. We still have a lot of work to do. I have been in New York now. New York is very much expected to go through for Obama, but what I've seen in the last two nights, I've gone to two charity events. Has scared the you-know-what out of me. And the reason is I sat next to people, pretty liberal, at least socially liberal, wealthy New Yorkers who are voting for McCain.
Is this because of the socialist word?
Because of the socialist word and because also of a little bit of the terrorism word, although that in this crowd is not as important, but it certainly has a little bit of sway. And that, I mean, you know, I've kind of sat there and I've been really shocked, and I know some of these people, some of them I didn't know. But I just want to say my little unscientific poll says this election is not finished. We'd like it to be, but it's not.
Yeah.
Now, interesting, as you know, unfortunately, when the economy is bad, the party who is not in the White House often gets in. I mean, that's fortunate for us. We don't like the economy to be bad. Mm-hmm. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics this morning said that Rhode Island has had the highest unemployment rate in the nation at 8.8%, Michigan 8.7%, eight other states above 7%, Mississippi 7.8%, which, as you know, it's a very close rate there. South Dakota had the lowest unemployment rate at 3.2%, Wyoming about the same. New Mexico actually has seen their state do a little better in terms of jobs, although still in a little bit of the danger zone. So that's the job situation, and it is a state-by-state issue. I mean, a difference, as you can tell, of almost over 5%.
Right. And not only that, as Kevin Phillips points out, the way that we measure unemployment right now is somewhere between 3 and 8 points lower than what we used to call unemployment before Reagan came into office, and sometimes as much as 10 points below what we used to call unemployment back when Franklin Roosevelt was in office.
Right, because we're not taking account the sort of chronically unemployed.
Right, and also, or the underemployed, or the people who have given up looking for, yeah, that's the chronically unemployed.
Part-time, right.
And we're now counting people in the military as being employed, and we used not to.
Well, as we used to, remember in that first statistics course you probably took, and the teacher had that book, How to Lie with Statistics?
Yes. I don't remember the book, no, but I know the old, what was it, Abraham Lincoln, you know, figures can figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
Right, exactly. Also, a very interesting little, the Federal Reserve announced this morning that they're going to begin to buy commercial paper from money market mutual funds. Now, this is very new, and again, this is the idea to inject liquidity into the credit markets, and they said that the short-term markets have been under considerable strain in recent weeks as money market funds and other investors have had difficulty selling assets to satisfy redemption requests. So this is interesting. This is the first time we have seen money market mutual funds being bought up by the Fed.
All of these are attempts to do top-down we're still doing trickle-down economics. Where, you know, nobody is talking about that if they want to actually revive this economy, as opposed to maintain some of the dysfunctional institutions of it over the next 6 months or a year. That if they actually want to revive the economy, they have to revive demand, and that means increasing wages. That means prolonging unemployment insurance and raising it. It means raising the minimum wage. That's the only thing that's going to drive actual demand and really rebuild this economy. And wages
getting real wages to people, because people have not had their real wages increased at the same time these CEO guys are just taking unbelievable profits.
Yep. Yep.
There is also my dear friends at Bulletin News have said, and they're usually pretty right about this because they get lots of gossip, that they are saying now that there may be a leadership fight particularly in the House under John Boehner, particularly the people under him. But if they lose 30 or more seats, they could have a huge change in their leadership, and people are already sharpening their claws.
Oh, that's interesting. In other words, Nancy Pelosi might be out.
No. Republicans.
Oh, Republicans. I see. Oh, Boehner is the one who's worried.
Right.
Oh,
very, very, very worried, apparently. And, of course, you know, Mitch McConnell is expected, possibly, at least the polls say, to win his election. But that doesn't mean that he will. And if he loses it, he's in pretty serious trouble. I mean,
the Republicans are
in serious trouble.
Yeah, the Senate side is up for grabs, too. Interesting. I'd like to see the Democratic Party, at least in the Senate, change their leadership. Harry Reid's a wonderful guy, but I'd much rather see Hillary Clinton as the Senate Majority Leader. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com is her website. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what's going on in Ohio? We should have known 4 years ago. Bob Petrakis, in fact, came out here to Portland, Oregon a year or two ago, and he and I shared a stage at the Unitarian Church in Portland. And Bob, it was great meeting you then. It's great to have you back on the show.
Oh, good to be on, Tom.
Bob is the professor of political science. He's an attorney. He's a reporter. He's executive director of the Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism and the editor of the Free Press. Freepress.org is the website. And, Bob, we breathed a sigh of relief when the Supreme Court said no to the Republicans in Ohio who wanted to challenge 200,000 new voter registrations. But now they're taking it back to the state Supreme Court. Isn't that the reverse order of the way things are supposed to go?
Well, they're smart enough to realize that $7 million of illegal and anonymous money that was found by the bipartisan Ohio Election Commission has made a swing state, 4-3 Supreme Court, a 7-0 political Republican-dominated court. So I think they're looking for a political decision in that court. And even if it goes back to the Supreme Court in their reverse, their strategy at this point, and it's a very Rovian strategy, is to create massive chaos on the ground in Ohio.
This is like what happened in 2000 in Florida.
Right, exactly.
But you have an attorney, or you have a Secretary of State, Ms. Jennifer Bruner. Who seems to be doing a good job, who's pushing back on this pretty aggressively. But you think that the 7-0 Republican Ohio Supreme Court might actually participate in this chaos, much like the U.S. Supreme Court did, 5-4 in 2000.
Yeah, I think what they're hoping is that they might get a political decision out of that court. Then it creates further chaos on the ground. And it also, I believe, sets it up for a challenge and suit if it doesn't go McCain's way in the election. So I think they're setting the groundwork. Also, Bruner, who won a Profile in Courage award, is now getting death threats. Her website is under attack, and she got a mysterious package with powder with threats all over it, according to the State Highway Patrol.
Boy, to say it's getting ugly is an understatement.
It's getting real. Yeah, and the prosecutors, the Greene County Sheriff, Mr. Fisher, Sheriff Fisher, went after 304 college students who registered and voted where the two historically black colleges are in Ohio. You got prosecutors, Republican operatives in Franklin County where Columbus is, and in Hamilton County in Cincinnati, going after people who registered voters and were in the state 90 days and registered to vote. They've criminalized the whole process. They've got the FBI running down Acorn civil RICO suits in Warren County, where Acorn says it never even did any work.
Mm-hmm. This is, frankly, I think some of this is the stuff that the Democratic Party should have done in 2000 and 2004 to expose the election fraud that the Republicans are engaged in. What they're doing is the classic strategy, the classic Karl Rove strategy of whatever you're doing, accuse your opponent of it. So when your opponent says, oh, no, you did that, you can say, hey, I said you did it first.
No, it's exactly what's happening here. You've got 8 million, more than 8 million voters in Ohio. There's only on the entire voter registration about 6,600 duplicative registrations, duplicates. And we studied this after the 04 election. We looked at, around the state randomly and found 770 people that had duplicate registrations. Not one of them voted, because when you show up with the exact same name, they remember you. Most of it's administrative error, but they're trying to create the mythology that there's this voter fraud, which will allow them, I think they hope, to steal it electronically or legally.
Right. But in fact, in all probability, this is what, people who moved recently or something like that, and they didn't unregister, they just re-registered, or?
Sure. And the Republican strategy, think about what they're doing. There's four different data banks. Every county board of election has a data bank. Secretary of State has a data bank. They're matching that against the Social Security Administration and the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. What the Republicans are seeking is that if there's any variation, you know, Robert J. Fitrakis, my name, and it comes up Robert Fitrakis or Bob Fitrakis, including the same date of birth and Social Security number, they want me challenged and my vote thrown out.
Right, which, you know, there's no conceivable reason for this other than, you know, this here, I just have to keep playing this as often as I can. This is Paul Weyrich, the Republican strategist, speaking to a group of Republicans. This is about 15 years ago. I mean, this is a long-standing strategy. This is the guy who put Ronald Reagan into office, ran his direct mail operation, and is still working with the Republican Party.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And that's it. That's it in a nutshell.
No, and they're doing everything humanly possible to repress voters. 600,000 new voters since January 1st. They want to challenge 200,000 of them because they know 75 to 80% of them are voting for Barack Obama.
Right. So you guys were pushing back. I know you are a party to a lawsuit in the 2004 election. What are you doing now?
Well, we've been negotiating ongoing with the Secretary of State, and she's done some amazing things. For example, you know, you think they're common sense things. But as part of that suit, one of the things she did, you know, in 5 minutes of negotiation, agreed that the caging with the undeliverable letters doesn't count, is that now if somebody is per the voting rolls, you actually have to notify them and give them a hearing.
Hmm.
I mean, there's a novel idea, due process.
Yeah. And I'm wondering how many of those 800,000 people who are recent registrants are actually people who are simply re-registering after they were caged by your former Secretary of State.
Well, you know, when you purge, and this is an astounding figure, a city that gave 81% or so of its vote to Kerry, when you purge 24.93% of every voter in Cleveland, every voter, that's the only reason that Bush won in 2004. It's just astounding that, and the Republican counties are no purge counties. They don't purge because it's a May provision under election law. It's not a shall. It's not a requirement. So all the urban areas, they're purging the poor and minority voters. And in the Republican areas, they have inflated voter rolls.
So isn't this a decision of the Secretary of State, or is this, I mean, how can the Republican counties not purge their rolls and the predominantly Democratic counties purge their rolls? That, it seems like, I mean,
it comes under it's federal law. It was a May provision. It was either in the Motor Voter or HAVA, or reinforced in HAVA, is that you don't have to. You have to maintain electronic or a roll, but you don't have to purge. The only place they're purging, the last time they purged primarily in Toledo, another Democratic stronghold, and the inner city of
Cleveland.
Right,
but who's the they that's doing this? This can't be the Secretary of State's office.
The Board of Elections. This time, what happened? Last time, it always come down to a 2-2 tie, right? The vaulted bipartisan boards of election. Mm. Two Democrats would vote one way, two Democrats the other, and J. Kenneth Blackwell would always side with the Republicans and purge. This time, what's stopping them is Jennifer Bruner saying, fine, you want to purge these people? Give them a hearing, notify them and give them a hearing. Here's the problem. We canvassed in Franklin County, where the capital is in Columbus, and 25% of the people actually live at the same address. They just don't like to answer letters from the Republican Party. We found an estimated 80% still are in the county, thus making them eligible to vote at their new address simply by providing a utility bill or some sort of federal document.
And yet they've been stripped off the voter rolls by this Republican caging effort. Holy cow. So, it's like these guys will stop at nothing. This is election fraud on steroids, and they're running around yelling about Acorn registering Mickey Mouse to vote as if Mickey Mouse is going to show up. And here we have right in front of us hundreds of thousands of voters being, in 2004, frankly, being purged, and now in 2008. Incredible. People can read all about it over at freepress.org. Bob Petraeus. Bob, thanks for the great work you're doing.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. 16 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. How do we push back? Oh, I got to tell you about Iceland, too. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program exposing the con and conservative. Welcome to our newest stations, by the way. FM 105.7 WHJX in Jacksonville, FM 92.5 WFJO in Folkestone, Florida, WZBK 1220 AM in Keene, New Hampshire, and in the Chicago area, 92.5 FM in the Rockford, Illinois and Southwest Wisconsin area, 92.7 FM, and in the Chicago North Side and Southern Wisconsin area, in the Chicago South Side, Northwestern Indiana, 99.9 FM. And great to be on all these new stations here. We have on an ongoing basis as the show continues to grow. Strange stuff going on out there in the world. Very strange stuff. Speaking of Jacksonville, Florida, police have filed additional charges against an inmate who they say tried to hide illegal drugs inside a Northside prison in the folds of his stomach. Yeah, a little chubby, I guess. 6'2", 290 pounds. He had a little extra room there to stash a bag of reefer. Pretty strange stuff. Okay, I told you I wanted to tell you about Iceland. I got to tell you, this is mind-boggling. And by the way, we're going to have Elle Tinklenberg with us at the end of the hour here. That should be interesting. Iceland, there's a great piece about this by Toby Sanger over at Alternet right now, alternet.org. Iceland is bankrupt. And everybody's looking at this going, holy cow, Iceland's bankrupt. There's $60 billion they owe overseas. This is a country of only 300,000 people. They owe $60 billion. That's six times their annual economic output. No, in the history of Western countries, no country has ever crashed so fast and so hard. And I think many people are inclined to think, oh, Iceland, it must be like Denmark and Sweden and Norway, one of those Scandinavian social democracies like Bernie Sanders talks about. How did they go under? How did they go bankrupt? How did they go broke? Well, it turns out that they went broke because since 1991, Iceland, this little country, has been run by a right-wing party that was actually inspired by Milton Friedman himself, the father of neoliberalism, the father of conservative economic policies, the guy who inspired trickle-down economics, Friedrich von Hayek, Milton Friedman, and Thomas Friedman, but Milton Friedman in particular. In 1984, he went to Iceland, and he participated in a televised debate with some socialists, and basically, you know, won the argument in the minds of many Icelanders Icelanders. And as a consequence of this, there's this whole generation of young conservatives who came up, who were kids in 1984, saw this debate, and created this party called the Independence Party. And they actually took control of the government in 1991. And now under the leadership of Prime Minister David Oddsson, who claims to be explicitly inspired by Friedman. As the article in Alternet notes, Iceland's neoconservative Young Turks implemented a radical but now familiar program of privatization, tax cuts, reduction in spending and deficits, inflation targeting, central bank independence, free trade, and exchange rate flexibility. Corporate taxes were cut from 50% to 18%. Privatization and deregulation were driven directly from the prime minister's office. And at first it looked like it was great, like it was very successful. The economy grew at a really strong pace. Well, you know, it's just like it did under Reagan for a while. If you spend trillions of dollars on a credit card, it looks like things are going well. In fact, the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Fraser Institute, all these right-wing think tanks, you know, went off on Naomi Klein for not talking about Iceland in her book, Shock Doctrine, as an economic success story, because it's run by right-wingers. And in fact, in Iceland, several new billionaires on this little island of fewer than a half a million people, it created several new billionaires. They'd never had a billionaire before until they put Milton Friedman's policies into place. And so they all thought, hey, this is cool. And then it came crashing down. As Toby Sanger writes, inflation and short-term interest rates escalated to 14%. Iceland's currency lost half its value. Now they have an external debt equivalent to $200,000 per person. Now keep in mind, our debt is equivalent to around $35,000 per person, $120,000 per household. This was caused by the same Milton Friedman-inspired economic policies that Ronald Reagan foisted upon the United States that were adopted by George Bush Sr., who called it voodoo economics at first, but then learned to love it, by Bill Clinton, who went along with this stuff and put into place Robert Rubin and Lawrence Summers and other devotees of Milton Friedman, and then was put on steroids by George W. Bush. It destroyed the economy of Iceland. And frankly, in my opinion, there's every chance it's going to destroy the economy of the United States. When you get the president of the United States, George W. Bush, on TV talking about the Great Depression, how we might be on the edge of another Great Depression, it took 26 years to do it here. It started in 1981 when Reagan was sworn into office. Iceland, it didn't take so long. They started in 1991. They started 10 years later. It only took them 16 years to destroy their country using conservative economic policies. What are they going to do now? They don't know. They're trying to borrow money from Russia. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Thank you.
Unbalanced. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, and time now for our Onion Alert from the Onion News Service. This breaking story.
Slight mishap on the campaign trail for John McCain. Staffers confirmed this morning that the 72-year-old senator was accidentally left on his campaign bus overnight after a speech in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. Joining us now from the War for the White House election analysis bunker with details is Jane Carmichael. Good to see you, Jane.
Hi, Andrea.
Now, how did campaign officials discover they had left Senator McCain all by himself?
Well, Andrea, according to a campaign spokesman, just after 7 a.m., two local Stroudsburg residents were taking a morning walk when they noticed a forlorn-looking McCain staring out a window on the bus.
Uh-huh.
When they asked him if he wanted to be let out, the senator nodded yes, and the women opened the door. We spoke with the women earlier via phone.
I saw all these scratches all over the window, and I thought something is going on here. He wants to get out.
Now, Jane, we've heard that the senator wasn't seriously injured.
That's right, Andrea. Apparently, several windows on the bus were open a crack, so he was in no real danger.
Oh, well, lucky for the senator.
Yes, he was apparently extremely thirsty and really needed to use the restroom, but he was otherwise okay. The women found his wife's phone number in one of McCain's coat pockets and used a cell phone to call her.
Well, that was smart thinking by whoever put that number in his pocket.
Yes.
Now, we understand there were some damages done to the bus.
Yes. Senator McCain ripped the bus seat fabric quite a bit and scattered a box of half-eaten granola bars throughout the interior. But McCain staffers were quick to point out that it was quite natural that the senator panicked after waking up to find himself all alone on a dark bus.
Of course.
McCain's spokesman answered questions about this earlier today.
Senator McCain has his good days and his bad days. This apparently was one of his bad days. He was resting comfortably now. We bought him some black licorice and a book of puzzles, so that ought to keep him busy for a while.
The campaign is taking steps to make sure this doesn't happen again. They plan to buy McCain a state-of-the-art communication and locating device. They're also planning to post a sign inside the bus reminding campaign staffers to double-check that they have the senator before locking the bus at night.
Well, it sounds like the McCain campaign learned a valuable lesson today,
Jane. You bet they did, Andrea. Absolutely.
Taking care of John McCain's a big responsibility.
No, it sure is, but they all knew that when they got him as their candidate, so
they
need to take this seriously.
Well, they certainly do, Jane. Thank you for the update. Although McCain doesn't appear to have suffered any injuries during his ordeal, campaign officials said that just to be safe, they plan to take him to the DOCTOR.
DOCTOR. TheOnion.com. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark in Daytona Beach, Florida, listening to WPOL 1590. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, how are you today, sir? Hey, I just want to make a quick comment. I keep hearing all the news talk shows, all the television news show programs, all over this, it was a signature from Mickey Mouse. It would never be used. Mickey Mouse ain't voting.
Right.
Now, I don't know where you're from. I'm in the Daytona Beach, Central Florida area. When you go down to the library or where you register to vote, you show an ID.
Yep.
And prefer it's a picture ID.
Yep.
So I don't think the point it's a big joke. Well, it was a Mickey Mouse signature. Are any of these people that Acorn are signing up 10, 20, 50, 90 times showing IDs to register to vote?
Well, this is where Acorn, this is the part of the story that isn't being told. And I just don't know why it's not being told, because Acorn is loud about this. When they hire somebody to do voter registration, they have 15,000 employees around the country, right? They hire somebody to do voter registration. That person is hired to go out and actually check people's IDs, certify that they check their ID, and take their registration in. When Acorn gets, say, a registration for Mickey Mouse or the Dallas Cowboys, starting line or whatever it may be, when they get one of those registrations, they immediately, number one, flag it as, this looks like a phony. Number two, they fire the person who brought it in. And number three, in all but two or three states, they're required by state law to turn it into the Secretary of State's office, but they do so with a flag on it that says, we don't think this is a legitimate voter registration, and if you want us to help prosecute the guy that we hired, we will do that. And they have Acorn has successfully prosecuted a number of their own employees over the last 8 or 9 years. And, but the law requires them to turn these things in. They're the ones who are telling the Secretary of State, this Mickey Mouse can't be possible. They're the ones who are telling the Secretary of State, hey, we've got 80 of them in the exact same signature. This is fraud. Acorn is the one telling the Secretary of State's office.
So, so how often, when the person who's registering people to vote, so-called registering them to vote,
right,
when they come in, I don't know how many signatures they have to get, 25 signatures to get paid. I have no idea. Do you know?
Actually, in most states, it's illegal to do it by the signature, so they have to pay them by the hour.
All right.
But there are certain, you know, minimum thresholds of behavior. And they're not quotas, but that if they don't meet, they don't keep their job.
They're coming in. They're handing in their sheets with their signatures. So it's not only the people who are out in the communities registering the people, but it must go farther up into the people they hand it into, because they had I'll say 18 to 21. They looked very young on the news the other night. I think it was Fox. I think. It was the Mike Huckabee show, matter of fact. The one young man said he registered 92 times because, you know, he got a cigarette and a dollar each time. The young girl, I'll say she was 18 to 21. They both looked young. I think she said something like 27 times.
Yeah, this is election fraud. There's two kinds of election fraud, or this is actually registration fraud.
So
and there's two kinds of this kind of fraud going on, Mark. Number one, you've got people
Acorn
who are trying to discredit Acorn. You've got people who are trying to discredit Acorn by going in and registering phony over and over and over again and doing these kind of things, and then mysteriously making themselves available to Fox News. So, number one. How much are these people being paid by the Republican Party to do this, to defraud Acorn? And then how much are they paid to go on Fox News? That's my first question. And number two, well, actually, that's both my questions. It's just, you know, Acorn is the victim here. And Acorn is trying to defend themselves. They're pointing out that they're the ones who are turning in these phony voter registrations. They're the ones who are willing to and aggressively have prosecuted the people who turn these things in. So, you know, if they're showing up on the Mike Huckabee show, I'm telling you right up front, there's something really stinking there. And it's not Acorn that stinks. It's those individuals who did that. And if they're going on right-wing television, they probably did it in an attempt, you know, sort of like the guys who say, yeah, I smuggled a bomb through airport security just so that they can get on TV or something like that. I mean, it's wrong. It's just wrong. Hera in Laguna Falls, California. Hey, Hera.
Hey. Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. I wanted to get in on this conversation because I have a phone call last night that was really upsetting. And this is coming to me from a 25-year-long friendship with a woman who is 67 years old and lives in Broward County, Florida. She and her husband went to vote, early voting, and she said to me, I can't believe what they're up to. I said, what's going on, Sandy? She said there were about 75 people, didn't take an exact head count, but give or take, who voted for Obama Biden and watched the vote on their voting machine change before their eyes.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't want to talk about conspiracy theories, but genuinely, these voting machines are provided, at least they are in our neighborhood, by the friends of the Republican Party most of the time who get the contracts for these things.
Diebold and ESNS, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, Diebold and ESNS are Republican-connected companies.
Well,
absolutely.
I said to her, well, so what did they do? She said, well, they stopped the voting for a while, and they said they would investigate and check into it. I said, did anybody get a receipt for their vote? She said, not that I could tell.
Please ask her to call her member of Congress, and if her member of Congress is a Republican, to call, you know, a Democratic member of Congress in a nearby district. Robert Wexler would be a great person to call if she lives in Florida.
She was going to call, what's her name,
Debbie Wasserman Schultz?
Yes.
Yeah,
because that's from her district.
Yeah, good. Tell her to call her congresswoman's office, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, well, actually, I would start there to get advice. And also call 1-866-OUR-VOTE, 866-OURVOTE.
Okay.
That's the nationwide hotline for election irregularity. And you know, call them and report this to them, because these things need to be more widely publicized. Hera, I got to move along, but thank you for sharing the story with us. It comports with the story that we just got about West Virginia. We've got two different counties now in West Virginia where exactly the same thing is happening. People push the button for Obama, and the screen flips to McCain. Thank you very much for voting for McCain. It's just like the Simpsons routine. Chris in Plano, Texas. Hey, Chris, a minute before the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Great show as always. I heard you this morning say that to be careful about straight voting, straight ticket voting.
Right.
And I just want to let you know, I'm in Plano, Texas, that I got an email from the Obama campaign as well as for or from Texas Democrats to go ahead that it was okay to vote a straight party ticket. So I just wanted you to know that, of course.
Perhaps it is okay in Texas. It was in New Mexico where the machine, see this, again, this wasn't state law. This machine was programmed, there were several machines in Santa Fe that were programmed so that if you voted the straight ticket, the top two, the Senate and the President didn't get counted.
Okay.
And there are some places where it's actually, that's actually the law. So it's, you know, it's strange stuff. Apparently Texas isn't. Chris, thanks for the heads up on that. But again, don't trust the machines. Make sure it's all right. And, you know, for that matter, if you can get not a provisional ballot, provisional ballots are placebo ballots, they're contested ballots. But if you can get a paper ballot, do it. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Budget and you botched Iraq, so we're taking our country back, one Senate seat at a time, one House seat at a time, one dog catcher seat at a time. Well, speaking of House seats, Michelle Bachmann was on Chris Matthews a couple of days ago and had this to say, the congresswoman from Minnesota, about her thoughts on who is American and who's not American.
What about people like Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, the liberals you were mentioning a moment ago? Where would you put them? Would you consider them anti-American as well?
I would consider them to have far leftist views.
Yeah, you put three words together, liberal, leftist, and anti-American. How do they all fit together, those three terms?
I think the people that Barack Obama has been associating with are anti-American by and large.
How many do you suspect of your colleagues as being anti-American?
What I would say is that the news media should do a penetrating expose and take a look. I wish they would. I wish the American media would take a great look at the views of the people in Congress and find out, are they pro-America or anti-America? I think people would love to see an expose like that.
An expose of that, yes. Michelle Bachmann McCarthy, apparently. Well, the person running against her is Al Tinklenberg. And Al, welcome to the show.
It's very good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. And the website for your campaign is Tinklenberg, TinklenBerg08.com, if I have that right.
Correct. Okay. You got that right.
And it's Elwin Tinklenberg. And tell us about your campaign, Elwin.
Well, we feel very good about our campaign, especially now. But before all of this happened, we had gotten a poll that came back, or the DCCC had gotten a poll that came back that suggested it was a virtual dead heat in the race. They had already committed over $1 million to the campaign because they believed it was a seat that we could win. And it was after all of those things had happened that she made this comment. So this really adds to what we saw as momentum coming our way. The numbers were looking good for us in the district. We were kind of fashioning ourselves here in Minnesota to be the Tim Walz campaign of 2008. And so we were very excited before all of this happened.
Yeah, but so to all of our listeners, here's your chance to help take one more House seat back from the Republicans and put it in the hands of a good progressive Democrat. Tinklenberg, T-I-N-K-L-E-N-B-E-R-G-08.com is the website. And this is your opportunity to participate in helping bring back democracy to this country. Here's this woman who is suggesting that there are anti-American people in the House and Senate. I find that obscene. Elwin Tinklenberg, what are the core issues on which you're running your campaign?
Well, there are a lot of them. I mean, she has voted against almost everything that's come along, everything that I care about: children's health, veterans benefits, the adjustments to Medicare for senior citizens. Just recently, she voted with only 28 other members of the House against extending unemployment benefits. When unemployment is growing the way it is, and it's at record levels here in Minnesota, she voted against extending unemployment benefits. I mean, this has been kind of an across-the-board approach for her, a very narrow ideological approach. And it's unfortunate in ways, but what she said is not out of character.
Right. Your opponent is a hardcore conservative, a Reagan-Bush conservative, and you're a Democrat and a progressive. Would you describe yourself that way?
Yeah, well, I would describe myself as a moderate. As you may know, we have both the Democratic endorsement in this race and the Independence Party endorsement in this race. And I think it reflects well the district, the character of the district, and the values of the district.
Elwin Tinklenberg, Tinklenberg08.com, the website, what sort of support do you need? Do you need people to make contributions? Do you need people to show up and help out? Do you need, volunteers? What are ways that our listeners can help you?
All of the above. Certainly the financial support is critical at a time like this. It allows us to make sure that people know there's an alternative. But the Get Out the Vote campaign is going to be really important, and is going to help support other Democratic candidates and support Senator Obama in the district. And so that volunteer support is critical as well. And those areas are really important to us in the last couple of weeks here.
Right. There's a link, by the way, to your website for our regular listeners over at TomHartmann.com on our homepage. So Elwin Tinklenberg, tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your background? What brought you to run for Congress against Michelle Bachmann, this crazy lady, in my humble opinion?
Well, I'd been involved in local government. I was a city council member here in Blaine, and then was mayor of Blaine for a number of years, and then was transportation commissioner for Minnesota under Jesse Ventura when he was governor. I wanted to get involved because we had a bridge collapse here in Minnesota. We were seeing a deterioration of our infrastructure. Transportation has been a big issue for me for a lot of years. But the other thing that's really important is that I got involved in public life to begin with because I wanted to help create jobs. I wanted to help grow the economy in my community. And we were able to do that here. And I think we can do that on the national level as well. If we can focus again on the fundamentals, that the economy really is about creating good jobs. And that's where we need to start. I certainly want to be a part of that. And we've been focusing a lot on the economy and on those things that can help create economic development.
Right. And you're not going to have good jobs if you don't have people who have decent wages so that they can buy things, so that there's enough demand that companies will want to make things so that they'll hire people. So
yeah,
Elwin Tinklenberg, Tinklenberg08.com is the website. Check it out. Elwin, good luck.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Coming up tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. Nationalizing our banks, the IRS helping illegal immigrants. What? Plus, former White House counsel John Dean is going to drop by. His book, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches, is now out in paperback. So join us. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmannRadio.com.